Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this, the third in a series of lectures given, as is usual at this time of year, under the auspices of the Lionel Robbins Memorial Fund. And as I imagine most of you have been to lectures one and two, let me say no more by way of introduction, except that Lester Farrow is one of the foremost economics educators, not only in America, but indeed in the world, and is the author of a prolific series of books, which his publisher has asked me to read out, but I don't think I need bother about. All I can say, I think, by way of a trailer, is that I think it's reasonable to assume that there probably will be a book based on the three lectures that we've had the privilege of hearing here in the course of this lecture. So without more ado, Lester Farrow, the final lecture on the plate tectonics of capitalism.
What I'm going to do this afternoon is talk about the earthquakes and the volcanoes. On day number one, we talked about the movement in those five fundamental plates. In day number two, we talked about what I call the economic surface of the earth, the distribution of purchasing power. And tonight I want to talk about various volcanoes and earthquakes that the plates are causing or will be causing. And I want to start with one that relates to directly from what we were doing last time with the distribution of earnings. Because if you look at those kind of dramatic changes in the distribution of earnings, they radically change how you run businesses and what you sell. And you see this very dramatically in the United States if you look at retailing. If you look at retailing in the United States, a whole set of companies have either gone broke or had enormous financial problems. And they've all been the middle class stores. The Macy's, the Gimbel's, the Sears, the equivalent of Marks and Spencer's. The upscale stores like the Bloomingdale's have done very well. The downscale stores like the Walmart's have done very well, and everybody in the middle has gone broke. Now, what's the chance, just based on sheer probability, that we could have geniuses running upscale stores and geniuses running downscale stores and all the idiots ran middle-class stores? The answer, of course, of that is it's highly improbable. And I would argue to you that God himself couldn't run the Sears company in the United States. Because it's the prototypical middle-class store, a brand name so strong that it cannot move upscale, and a brand name so strong that it cannot move downscale. And the problem is, its customers are dying or disappearing economically. And if your customers disappear, what do you do if you can't move? The answer is, you go out of business with them. Now, one of the things that somebody mentioned afterwards, it obviously is a little bit of mystery. If you looked at the numbers I had on the board, the question is, if you saw the numbers I had in the board, where did all that income go? Well, the basic answer is the income went to the elderly. Because in the United States, if you take the period from the early 70s to the early 90s, the elderly have more than doubled their share of national income. And during this period of time, the elderly have gone from being relatively poor to being relatively affluent. In the early 1960s, the elderly had a per capita income about 60% of that of the non-elderly. Today, they have an income 120% that of the non-elderly. And that's created a whole set of new industries. There are people who have literally made billion-dollar fortunes on the cruise line industry. What makes the cruise line industry? The elderly. Because it's the perfect vacation for somebody that has limited mobility. You get on, and if you don't feel like moving, you don't move. The ship moves. And if you don't feel well, you don't get off. The love boat is, in fact, full of canes. And if you don't believe this, go watch people get off the love boat someday. I had a chance by accident to do it last summer when I was in Vancouver, and one of the cruise ships coming down the Inland Passage off the coast of British Columbia was docking in Vancouver and unloading as I was running by, so I stopped to watch. You'll see a lot of wheelchairs, a lot of walkers, and a lot of canes. And so On the other side, who's been the big loser? The biggest loser are people 18 to 35 years of age. In the United States, their share of total national income has essentially halved over this same period of time. And what that means, we haven't yet seen it because they haven't caught up with the facts of life, we're going to see dramatic changes in our TV programs. Because if you think of the demography of TV, what the advertisers always want is that 18 to 35-year-old group. Because the assumption is that they're relatively affluent, their income is going to be rising, and they have habits that haven't yet been fully formed, it's easier to push their preferences around. The problem is, it may be easy to push their preferences around, but if they don't have any income, you aren't interested in an advertiser in that particular set of demographies. And so I think if you look at the media industry and TV, you're going to see a big change of programming over the next 10, 15 years, shifting away from the program that young people like and shifting towards the programs that elderly people like, simply because the advertising follows the money, and that means the programming has basically followed the money. And so if you're in the business of running a business, you've got to worry about who's got the purchasing power and how do you chase that purchasing power. And so you're going to see big changes in where that's focused. One of the other places you're going to see an earthquake going on in business is, I mentioned yet last time, the end of the post-World War II social contract. That social contract said, if you work hard, learn what you're supposed to learn, move where you're supposed to move, and the company is profitable, you will have a lifetime job plus annual real wage increases. That contract no longer exists. The problem is, what do you replace it with if you're a business firm? What's the new social contract? Now, in the short run, the contract can simply be fear. Do what you're told or I'll fire you. In the long run, that presumably isn't viable. Because what's also happening at the same time in the business community, if you look at this phenomenon of the brain power industries I talked about, is one of the plates. Companies are finding that they can get dramatic sources of what I would call soft productivity. That's what the Chrysler Corporation has done. In a period of 5 years, it's essentially turned itself from a company that was the sickest big automobile company in the world to a company that is now the most profitable automobile company in the world and has the lowest cost of production. And what are they and people like themselves done? Chrysler Corporation has done essentially two or three things, one of which, when they did it and I was invited to the opening, I said to myself, and actually out loud to one of my neighbors, this can't be smart. But it just showed how dumb I was. The Chrysler Corporation spent $1 billion in Detroit building a large building that basically has six rooms in it. In each of those six rooms, 6,000 people can work, what they call platform teams. And previously, they had design, research and development, marketing, all these people spread all over Detroit. They simply forced them into one room and said, you've got to work together, breaking down those functional barriers. Second thing they did is they went to their supplier network and said, there used to be 3,000 of you. There will now be 600 of you. We're going to work with you on ease of manufacturing in terms of the design process. We'll help you with engineering and transfer technology to you. But in return, you're going to do something for us. You're going to give us a 3% price cut on what you sell to us every year forever, no excuse, regardless of what the general rate of inflation is. The third thing they did was basically to push decisions down the hierarchy. What's the lowest possible level at which you can make decisions? And so if you go to the loading docks at the Chrysler Corporation, you will find somebody there with a little handheld computer unloading the parts as they come in, logging them into the computer. The computer prints out a check automatically and he hands it to the truck driver. So there's no accounting office processing purchasing. The problem with all of that is it requires a workforce which is dedicated, loyal, and very educated, because the guy at the top has to communicate the strategy of the firm to the guy at the bottom, and the guy at the bottom has got to be capable of taking that strategy and making the decisions that the boss himself would make if he were in that particular space. And you would say that that particular earthquake would demand a workforce that's more attached to the company, not a workforce that's less attached to the company. And I think the problem is, at the moment, this is a genuine earthquake with a giant crack in the earth, because nobody knows what the new social contract should be, how it should be organized, and how it should be placed. Although there's a lot of suspicion that whoever figures out what this new social contract is probably going to have a little edge on the system. Let me talk in a little bit of a detail about the earthquake, or maybe volcano, called China. On day number one, we talked about the end of communism, and China becomes interesting because, of course, it's almost a quarter of humanity, which has decided to not live in the Middle Kingdom, isolated from the rest of the world, but to basically join the capitalist economy and become export-oriented. And it's, of course, doubly interesting because the Chinese are as successful moving to the market economy as the old Soviet Union in Eastern Europe is a failure. China goes uphill at 10% a year, while Eastern Europe goes downhill at 10% a year. So the question is, what's the sources of the difference? The place to start on this particular volcano is probably with the realization that when you read about those 10 or 12% growth rates in the press, there's a bit of exaggeration. There's a bit of exaggeration for a very simple reason. Local officials in China get a bonus based on how rapidly their province or city grows. Those same local officials keep the statistics. And periodically, the guys in Beijing have to discipline some local official for grossly exaggerating, but my assumption is that there is always some exaggeration. The other thing about those high growth rates to remember is some of it just really reflects the inefficiencies of communism. And it's a temporary phenomenon that cannot be sustained. For example, if you take the end of the communes in China, and this is one of the places where the Chinese got the game right. The first thing the Chinese did, you remember, was to privatize agriculture. Within 18 months, in the late 1970s, the Chinese broke up the communes and handed every hectare to a peasant. Now, technically, they didn't sell it. They gave it to them on a 75-year lease. But 75 years is a long time, and every peasant knows that it will never be given back. But by simply getting rid of the communes, with no investment in pesticides, no investment in fertilizer, no investment in machinery, no investment in transportation, they tripled agricultural production in the next 10-year period of time. And in the 1970s, if you went to Beijing, you would have found a pile of rotten peaches. Today, if you go to Beijing, you will find the finest peaches in the world because they will be ripened on the trees, and some peasant will literally almost hand carry them to you in your hotel. The problem, of course, is that's a one-shot transition. It gives you a lot of economic growth for a while, but you eventually get to the point where you don't get more growth of that sort, and you have to start making the investments. One of the problems the Chinese have at the moment is that source of growth has stopped, and for a long time, for about 10 years, rural incomes were keeping up with urban incomes. Rural incomes in the last 5 years have started to stagnate because the Chinese haven't made the investments in the rural areas. Not too long ago when I was in China, somebody said to me, if you have a chance, just go to the railway station in Beijing or Shanghai, stand there and watch for 2 or 3 hours. And you will see peasants rolling in from the countryside like you have never seen in your life. And at the moment, the estimate is that there are probably about 50 million undocumented Chinese from rural areas rolling around the big cities of the coastal areas who are not supposed to be there. The problem, of course, is at some point you do have to make those investments in the agricultural area. And when you do it, you've got to take the money basically out of the manufacturing area where it's now being invested, which will slow down growth rates. A second place where the statistics show very rapid growth, but you want to understand why they show it, under communism, typically services weren't counted as growth. Under capitalism, they are. And one of the things that's happening in China is every year they add a few more statistics to their GNP, few more service industries to their GNP statistics. And since you're going from zero, not really from zero, but statistically from zero to some large positive number, it starts to give you a very good rate of growth, but it's a little bit of exaggeration. Looking forward, the other problem China has is obviously infrastructure. China is a society that probably has less infrastructure than any other country, rich or poor, on the face of the globe. And it has less infrastructure for two reasons. India, for example, has 10 times as many miles of railway line as China. Because in India, the British Army built railways to move the British Army around India. China had the disadvantage of being a quasi-colony, but nobody's colony, so nobody took the responsibility for building infrastructure. The other thing that led to a lack of infrastructure, which I'll talk about here in a minute, was that Chairman Mao didn't believe in infrastructure. And so they'd have none of the heavy infrastructure that was built in Eastern Europe for reasons which I'm going to talk about. There was no railroad building, no road building, very little communication building outside of the military, same thing on air travel between various regions of China. Now, all of this is to say that there's probably a little bit of exaggeration in the statistics, especially when they talk about the 10% growth rate at the moment, because 80% of China is rural. They admit that rural incomes aren't growing. How do you have a whole economy growing at 10% if 80% of it isn't growing? I think the answer is you don't. Now, none of that is to not say that they're not having a phenomenal performance. They are having a phenomenal performance. I don't think it's 10% per year, but it's clearly a very good performance. Question is, why the good performance? I would like to argue to you this afternoon that there are three essential things that have allowed the Chinese to succeed that the Eastern Europeans don't have. First, you can't move from communism to capitalism without an effective government that can make, take, and enforce decisions. Because how does capitalism get started? Capitalism gets started by somebody deciding who owns what. And if the state owns everything under communism, the state has to decide who owns what. The Chinese government, whether you like it or hate it, is capable of making those decisions. The governments in Eastern Europe are not capable of making those decisions, and a certain amount of what we call mafiaism in Eastern Europe is what I would call voluntary self-privatization. For example, take housing. Why would you ever buy your house in the communist world? In both China and Russia, people were putting 1% of their income into housing. In capitalist world, you put 30 or 40% of your income into housing. If you buy your house on day number one, you got the same lousy house, and now it's taken 30% of your income to heat it, maintain it, pay taxes on it, where previously you got the same lousy house for 1% of your income. The Russians have basically talked about privatizing housing, but very little of it's been done. The Chinese have simply said, you will buy your house. Not too long ago, I was with a group of officials from the foreign ministry who were all bitterly complaining about having to buy their house. They were getting it for about a third of construction cost, which makes it a great deal in capitalistic terms, but it's a lousy deal in cash flow terms. But they were told, buy your house or lose your job. And so they were all buying their house. And like the privatization of land, the Chinese will have relatively quickly privatized the supply of housing when the Russians are still just talking about privatizing the supply of housing. I don't know if you noticed it, but last December 8th, a year ago December 8th, there was an interesting phenomenon in China that I think illustrates the difference between having an effective government that can make decisions and carry out plans and one that couldn't. The Chinese were embarrassed by the fact that there were a few cases of polio in China. We should be embarrassed about that in the United States because there are a few cases in the United States too, and if every child is vaccinated, there will be zero cases. So the Chinese had a day on December 8th, 1993, where basically the 200 million children of China were told to stay at home and either prove that they had been vaccinated or be vaccinated. And I think the British government could vaccinate every child in Britain in one day? I suspect the answer is no. But it's an illustration of a government that can basically make, take, and enforce decisions. The Chinese are getting a Marshall Plan. They're getting a Marshall Plan from the overseas Chinese. It amounts to somewhere between $10 and $20 billion a year. But the more important thing is the human talent and knowledge. If you go to the factories in Guangdong and Fujian, you will find that at some point in the history of those factories, almost every factory has had an overseas Chinese as a manager. because that's a person who is very important in capitalism, and it's a person who doesn't exist in communism. Suppose I ran a factory in the old Soviet Union or the old PRC. I was the equivalent of an army colonel. There was a central plan, the marching battle orders. They sent me people, they sent me materials, they sent me components, they sent me money, they told me what to make, they told me when the flat car would arrive. I put the stuff on the flat car and it disappeared. I never sold anything, I never bought anything, I never did any marketing, I never knew who my customers were. I followed orders. Now, I don't know what the success rate on turning army colonels into business people is in Great Britain, but I know in the United States it's precisely zero. That is a completely different mentality. You cannot work with the old economic army colonels. They have to be junked. And in Eastern Europe, they're trying to run the system with the army colonels. In China, basically, the overseas Chinese, for a period of time, become the plant managers, train the new plant managers, and you have a group of people who know how to play the system. And you also have a group of people who have all the context in the capitalistic world for playing the game. What do people want to buy elsewhere? That's what Hong Kong, Taiwan, the American Chinese community, the Indonesian Chinese community bring to the table as a help. The third big advantage I think that the Chinese have over Eastern Europe comes out of the idiosyncratic behavior of the two people who built the two economies. The Russian economy, of course, was built by Joe Stalin, Marshall Stalin. The Chinese economy was built by Chairman Mao. Question: where did Marshall Stalin learn his economics? Answer was, he learned it from the Ford Motor Company in LaRouge plant in Detroit in the 1920s. That was a plant where iron and coal ore came in one end, 100,000 people worked in the facility, and cars came out the other end. And in the 1920s, that was believed to be the secret of capitalism. Enormous economies of scale and backward vertical integration. In the capitalist world, we quickly learned that didn't work. Marshall Stalin populated the entire Soviet Union with such plants. There's one estimate, I'm not sure how these estimates come into existence, but there's one estimate that says that 77% of all the consumer products made in the Soviet Union, a country of 280 million people, were made in one and only one factory. How do you privatize that? If you privatize it, you're just creating a local monopoly. And if I gave a capitalist a factory with 250,000 workers in it, what would he do with it? Shut it down, because he knows it doesn't work. And what's the other problem? Those factories are now in 15 different countries who can't trade with each other. So everybody has too much of some things and not enough of other things. And if you just think about the physical steel and concrete, it's an economy that is very difficult to privatize. Forgetting the human problems, which are even more severe. Where did Chairman Mao learn his economics? Answer: Chairman Mao learned his economics from the Japanese Army. Remember the famous statement of Chairman Mao in the middle of World War II when it looked like the Japanese would win? He said, let's think about it for a moment. Suppose the Japanese were to put one Japanese soldier in every Chinese village. That would still mean that half the villages of China had no Japanese soldiers. They can't win. And that's why he believed that if there was nothing so important that destroying it made a difference to the whole economy, and nothing to be captured, nobody could conquer China. And he was absolutely right. That's why he didn't believe in regional infrastructure. He believed in regional self-sufficiency. That's where the backyard steel furnaces come, and every town's got a bicycle factory, a watch factory, a canning factory, a cement factory. It's equally crazy in the sense it's enormous diseconomies of scale, and it creates an economy that's now got enormous infrastructure problems. But it's very easy to privatize, because it's basically an economy of small-scale industries. Now, China has a few of these big facilities, like Beijing Iron and Steel, with 250,000 people attached to it right outside of Beijing, that were given to them by the Russians, but relative to the whole economy, they had very little of that, and it allows them to go on. Now, the other thing should be said is that if you read the press about China, there's a lot of exaggeration. You can read press articles that it sounds like the Chinese are going to join the modern industrial world in the next 20 years. It's not going to happen. Because the fact of the matter is, currently China has a per capita GDP. If you use currency values, it's $400 per capita. If you use the World Bank's estimate of purchasing power parity, it may be as high as $1,750 per capita. Japan has a per capita GNP of $36,000. If you look at Germany, Japan, and the United States over the last 100 years, they've each grown between 3 and 4% a year. Let's assume they don't do quite as well as their 100-year average. They go down to 3 for the next 100 years. No economy in all of human history has ever done better than a 4% per year real growth rate over a 100-year period of time. But let's assume the Chinese do 50% better. They average 6. Get out your little hand calculator. Have the Japanese growing at 3% a year starting at 36,000. Have the Chinese growing at 6% a year starting at either $400 or $1,750. Grind out the numbers to 2100 105 years from now, and what will you find? You'll find that the Chinese per capita GNP is still no better than about two-thirds that of Japan. Now, that's not to say that China is not going to be important. But today, China is 1% of the world GNP. Japan is 15% of the world GNP. It is, in fact, a small market on world standards, despite the fact that it has 1.2 billion people. Nobody is a bigger China optimist than I am. I think this recent report in the United States claiming that China was going to fall apart, basically when Deng Xiaoping dies, is highly dubious. On the other hand, I think it's important to be realistic about it. The Chinese have had a good strategy, they've executed well, they clearly have a very good growth rate, and they're going to be a player in the world economy. And as I mentioned when we were talking about the plates, the place where they, in all of the second world, will have a big impact on the system was the fact that the communist world, in general, ran a good school system. They're full of relatively well-educated people, and that's particularly the case in the case of China, where they could build on the Confucian tradition as well as the communist tradition of emphasizing education. The Chinese are going to put pressure not just on the developed world, but on the underdeveloped world. If you go to northern Argentina and southern Brazil, you already see the pressure. The big export industry in that part of Latin America is cheap leather shoes. The Chinese are taking the market away from them. And the market share of Argentina and Brazil is going down, and the market share of China is going up. And so the Chinese are not just going to take markets away from high-paid workers in the developed world, they're also going to take markets away from relatively low-paid workers in the underdeveloped world. The other thing to be said, however, is that wages are not as cheap in China as they look. Suppose I have a society where food is basically free, housing is basically free, transportation is basically free. How do I make that society work? Well, I adjust wages to the fact that all of those things are free. And if I put housing up to market rates and food up to market rates and transportation up to market rates, what have I got to do with my wages? I got to push them up to market rates. And very quickly, China will have wages higher than India and have wages higher than most, a lot of the underdeveloped world, because we're in this very peculiar period of time when they have these the wages of communism and are playing the capitalistic game. China also has the problem that all the second world countries do, that the definition of efficiency in the communist world was very different than the definition of efficiency in the capitalist world. There are a lot of things that are going to have to be shut down. For example, if you go to Ningbo, which is a big seaport right south of Shanghai, you will find an enormous paper factory there. That paper factory processes used paper for the United States, which is made into new paper for China. It is something that would shut instantly under capitalism. Because the only reason it exists is no charge for transportation, no charge for electricity, no charge for pollution, no charge for raw materials. Of course you can make money if you have that kind of an environment. But the minute you have to pay for those fundamental inputs, that factory is going to shut down. And of course that means a subtraction from the growth rate. One of the things we don't know about the old Soviet Union when it comes to raw materials, of how many of these raw material deposits are economic in Western terms as opposed to economic in Russian terms, in communist Russian terms. But China is a volcano which is going to hit the world economy. The next earthquake or volcano I'd like to talk about is the issue of business cycles. Every social system, as I mentioned earlier, has some strengths and some weaknesses. Capitalism has two weaknesses, one of which I want to talk about at the moment, and that is it's cyclical. The problem, of course, is that that cyclical characteristic of capitalism came very close to making Mr. Marx right. Remember, he said capitalism was going to end. In 1939, there weren't very many capitalist countries in the world left. Basically, Great Britain and the United States. Because a combination of fascism, communism, plus the Great Depression, it came very close to wiping it all out. Lord Keynes then invented Keynesian economics, and in the period after World War II, we still had cycles, but they were much less severe. The problem, of course, is in our new global world economy, Keynesian countercyclical monetary and fiscal policies are basically dead. You can't do fiscal policies because of the elderly. Everybody's running large budget deficits, everybody has lost the capacity to raise taxes, and therefore everybody's lost the capacity to have fiscal policies. And you see it now. In the 50s and 60s, the minute a country had a recession, you'd be busy off fiddling around with fiscal policies. Today, nobody does it, no matter how bad or how long the recession. The same thing is basically true with monetary policies. I'm going to come back and talk about inflation in a minute here, but think about Mr. Greenspan. He's raised interest rates 7 times in the last 12 months. British interest rates have gone up 0.5 point today because of the actions of Mr. Greenspan yesterday. The world economy, at best, is just coming out of a recession. And here we are pushing interest rates up. And, of course, part of the problem has to do with a world economy where electronically you can now move massive amounts of money around the system very rapidly. And the only way the governments have to control that is to try and entice the money into their economy with high interest rates. And that is a system that leads to a world of high interest rates. Think about the Mexican problem. Compare it with the French 2 years earlier. When the tack was made on the British pound, the Italian lira, and the French franc a couple of years ago, France was the interesting story. Because in France, all the fundamentals were correct. They had a lower inflation rate than Germany, higher growth and productivity rate than Germany, a surplus in their balance of payments, and they could still be attacked by the international financial markets. Now, people talk about mistakes in Mexican economic policies, and there are a few, but they are very minor. But what's the net result in Mexico of the Mexican financial crisis? Do you know what the interest rate is in Mexico this morning? For peso loans, 60%. And on dollar loans, it's 20%. Mexico is going to have a recession. It's being engineered by the world financial community. And as those funds slosh around the world, they force everybody up to higher interest rates. And the problem is very simple. At the moment, using American ways of counting, there's $1 trillion a day that moves in world financial markets, $1,000 billion a day in British accounting. All the economies of the world move only $3 trillion a year in exports and imports. So in 3 days, the financial community moves more money than all the people working in the entire face of the globe move in an entire year. And those swings completely dominate the system, and it's one of the places where every economist that I know, with one exception, and I am not that one exception, was wrong in the early 1970s. When the world basically got rid of capital controls and opened up flexible exchange rates, what we all said in the early 70s, with the exception of Charlie Kindleberger, who is a historian who studies the Great Depression, was, well, exchange rates have got to reflect the realities of productivity and inflation. And when you have fixed exchange rates, it means every once in a while you have to have a big change in exchange rates. And if you have flexible exchange rates, they'll change by small amounts on a day-to-day basis, but it'll all be a more smooth, harmonious system. We couldn't have been more wrong. The world has never had bigger swings in exchange rates and bigger flows of capital back and forth around the world since we moved to flexible exchange rates, and over and undershooting is endemic for a whole variety of reasons. And it can't be stopped. If the governments hadn't abolished capital controls, technology would have abolished them. In the good old days, when you wanted to move money from Italy to Switzerland, you had to put it in your backpack and walk across the Alps. Today, I move money on my PC. When I can move money on my PC, there is no such thing as a government stopping me from moving money. So the problem, of course, is what happens if another Great Depression occurs? They're endemic to capitalism, cycles. How do we get organized to have counter-cyclical policies? Let's talk about inflation and deflation. I would like to argue to you that one of the impacts of these five plates is we are moving from an inflationary to a deflationary world. The 70s and 80s were a decades of inflation. You can tell the story as to why. The United States misfinanced the Vietnam War. We were then hit by the OPEC oil shocks. It was followed by the food shocks. Labor union contracts had escalator clauses all around the world. Inflation got started and propagated. And the 70s and 80s were decades of high rates of inflation for the industrial world. I would like to argue, however, that the 90s are not and will not be such a decade, nor will the early 21st century. When Alan Greenspan started raising interest rates a year ago in January, I had an article in the New York Times called Ghostbusters. As I mentioned, no ghost has ever killed a single human being. But many people who think they see ghosts have killed human beings. And the interesting thing about inflation in the United States is there is none. The measured rate of inflation on consumer prices is a little bit above plus 2. Alan Greenspan himself has testified to Congress that because we don't measure improvements in quality and services, and because we undermeasure improvements in quality in manufactured goods like computers, that the inflation index exaggerates inflation by 1.5%. That gets us down to an inflation rate of 0.5. And then we've got a 10% rate of inflation in healthcare that has nothing to do with interest rates in the general economy. 15% of the GNP is healthcare. That means there's another 1.5 percentage points of inflation in healthcare that can't be controlled with monetary policies. So it means if you leave healthcare out of the system, you're talking about an inflation rate of something like minus 1%. And if you're talking about producer prices, the producer price index in the United States today is less than it was 18 months ago. Question is, why the ghosts? And of course, what happened not today or yesterday when he raised interest rates, because now everybody expects it, but what happened last January? The world's shrewdest investors, like George Soros, lost $800 million himself, and there were a whole group of them, because they had no inflationary expectations and were caught by surprise when the Federal Reserve Board raised interest rates. Now the question is, why is there no inflation in the system? I think there are a variety of answers, and it's important to understand them. First, something happened which was the opposite of the Vietnam War and the food and oil shocks of the early 70s. It was the asset crash of the late 80s and early 90s, which completely changes the psychology with the enormous fall in real estate values, which affected everybody's psychology and mentality. I don't know about the house you live in, but the house I live in sells for about 40% less than it did at its peak. We're also building a world where if you think about inflation, it can't basically occur in a single country, because what counts is global capacity and global unemployment. At the moment, the American automobile industry is having a booming period of time, and they're close to capacity. But what would happen if the American automobile industry dared to raise prices? The answer is there's about 30% excess capacity out there in the world, either in Europe or Asia, and they would very quickly lose market share. And on a worldwide basis, if you say, what product is there that if I wanted to buy it, I would have a long time waiting before it was delivered to me, you're not going to find very many products in that category. But there have been a whole series of structural changes caused by these plates that I think moves us from a world of inflation to deflation. One of them relates to the collapse of communism. Remember the raw material shocks. How do you have a raw material shock, given all the raw materials that are going to flow out of the second world, and given what we know is happening with the Green Revolution and the material science revolution? There just isn't any scenario you can sketch out where you get another raw material shock. How do you have inflation when, as we've seen, wages are falling for 80% of the population and productivity has been speeding up and labor costs are falling all across the board? And if you think of those downsizings we talked about yesterday, that's a powerful anti-inflation motive. I mentioned the Chrysler Corporation and its supplier relationships. How do you get inflation if every big company in the world, and they're all moving in that direction, has a deal with their suppliers to lower the price X percent per year regardless? How do you get inflation when you got 3 billion people in the third world who want to be export-oriented? How do you get inflation when there is no Keynesian locomotive and when a recession starts, you can't count on it being quickly reversed the way you did in most of the post-World War II period? I think the answer is you don't. I argued a year ago and I would argue today that Alan Greenspan is a ghostbuster. Now, there are reasons for him to chase ghosts. It's what makes central banks important. If there wasn't any inflation, central banks wouldn't be important. Let's think a minute about capitalism. Why did capitalism come into existence in the early 1800s? The basic answer is the invention of the steam engine. You couldn't have capitalism until there was a way to accumulate capital. And you couldn't accumulate capital until there was some power source that could run that equipment. When the economy was based on land and the ownership, concentrated ownership of land, that's called feudalism. Capitalism came with the steam engine. The steam engine was eventually replaced by the internal combustion engine and the electrical motor, but it didn't fund that allowed a little bit more distributive processing when it came to the economy. But it didn't fundamentally change the nature of the game. But what about the plate that says we're moving into an era where the only capital is human capital, which can't be owned? What does capitalism mean and become in that kind of an era? If you look at the business firms we have now, which have that reality, consulting firms, software firms, investment banks, accounting firms, they're not organized the way Exxon and General Motors would be organized. Usually they're partnerships, sometimes they're listed on stock exchanges, but the CEOs and owners play very different roles in those kind of firms than they play in traditional industrial firms. And so in some sense, at precisely the moment when capitalism has no competitor from socialism or communism, capitalism itself will have to reinvent itself because it's moving into a world where the ownership of a piece of equipment doesn't give you much of an advantage because everybody in the world can quickly have that piece of equipment, borrowing in New York, London, and Tokyo and buying from a supplier who would be glad to sell it to them. This is one of those places where I don't think we know how capitalism is going to be organized and how it's going to define itself because it's something that has yet to happen. Some earthquakes that occur in the social area as opposed to the business area. One of the things which we see interestingly at the moment in most of our economy is the private is squeezing out the public. If you talked about a medieval town, how would you describe it? Well, you would say it has walls around it and a guard at the gates, right? Roman towns didn't have walls around them and guards at the gate. That's been a medieval phenomenon. In the United States at the moment, the interesting thing is over the last 10 years, we've had 4 million people enter what are called walled and gated communities, where you put a wall around a group of houses, one entrance, a guard at the gate with his machine gun, and you determine who gets in and who doesn't. There's a great community called Hidden Valley in California that has a hydraulic device called a bollard that shoots a 3-foot metal cylinder into the bottom of your car if you try and enter in an authorized way. Now, if you think about these walled and gated communities, what are they against? Public services and the taxes that have to pay for them, because they have essentially moved into a private world where those services are provided to them privately. And the interesting thing is, in the United States in 1970, we had twice as many public policemen as we had private policemen. Today, we have twice as many private policemen as we do public policemen. And of course, if I buy my own security guard, I'm not interested in hiring a public policeman to guard you. And so what you see is a systematic movement towards basically the private squeezing out the public. You see it if you look at higher education in the United States. When I got my degree in America with a PhD from Harvard, despite the fact that I had a family that could not make large educational investments, I graduated without a single educational debt. That is inconceivable today. I got my PhD on something called the National Defense Education Act, because the argument was, because of the Cold War, it wasn't just an individually good thing if somebody got a PhD, it was kind of socially necessity, and therefore society should pay for it. So in private universities, we basically swung from scholarships to loans. In public universities in the United States, the percentage paid for by the state is going down every year, and the percentage that has to be paid for with private tuition is going up every year. And if you look at the most recent recession and say, when state and local governments who control elementary and secondary education had to cut back their budgets, what did they cut back the most? The answer was elementary and secondary education, for a very simple reason. The elderly don't like it, and they vote against it. And in the United States, oftentimes to pass school budgets, you have to have a referendum. In the state of Arizona, if you raise budgets even by $1, you have to have a referendum. And the elderly simply vote against those referendums, and therefore the spending has to go down, which means you shift from public to private. Now, the problem, of course, is if you look at our societies historically, it has been that public education that has been one of the big egalitarian pushes. People would probably say the most egalitarian thing American government ever did was the GI Bill that gave every veteran, and of course there were 12 million of them at the end of World War II, a free university education. If you talk about private education, it's something that people who are well-educated do the most investment for a very simple reason. They have the most money, they know it pays off, and they can afford to take the risk because it's high risk. Don't have the money, it can sometimes be hard to get the money, you don't see the direct payoff, and you can't afford the risk. Because if you think about that variance in earnings that we were talking about yesterday, it does something interesting for education. If you look at males in the United States, 20% of the males who graduate from college will end up earning less than the median high school graduate. 30% of the graduates from high school will end up making more than the median college earnings. Now, on a net basis, there's a big payoff to getting education, but with a very high risk factor. And it's one of the reasons why people with low income tend not to invest. It isn't an automatic guaranteed payoff. A lot of uncertainty and a lot of risk. In a minute, I'm going to talk about one of the other defects of capitalism, but let me talk about it a little bit in this context. One of the big problems of capitalism is it's myopic. It has a very short-term time horizon. Because using discounted net present values, which is the way capitalists are supposed to make decisions with any reasonable interest rate, the net present value of a dollar 7 or 8 years in the future is approximately zero. So you never plan more than 7 or 8 years into the future. So now let's suppose you're a capitalist mother or father, no more, no less, hard-nosed as hell. And you're thinking about investing in 16 years of education for your own children. That's a zilch investment. Can't possibly pass capitalistic muster, which is why a lot of families don't do it. The conundrum, of course, is that as if everybody does it, we know it has enormous payoffs for society as a whole. Now, private business firms do a lot of education. But what is a private business firm going to do? Private business firm is a cost minimizer, which means it gives the education to the people who are cheapest to teach, which means the people who already have the most education. If you believe the philosophy that what you learn in school is how to learn, and I think that's basically right. If you think about the political earthquakes and volcanoes, one of the big ones coming along, of course, is there's a disconnect being developed between the nation state and the global economy. When I can move capital and business around the world, what role does the nation state play in that? For example, take research and development. Governments have typically paid for research and development, or long-tailed research and development. But what happens if I do research and development as the taxpayer in the government, and the business firms who take that technology then move it to the Philippines, because that's where they think it's most profitably employed? Why should I pay for R&D if they're going to use it in that way? And if I'm going to pay for R&D, how do I stop them from using it in that way? I would argue that basically the Tory Eurosceptics don't understand this disconnect. The British currency is going to be dominated by what goes on in Europe, whether you're in or out of a common currency. And that's the fact of life. The Bank of England has very little independent power one way or the other. And so your basic choice is to join a European currency, and then presumably there will be some board of directors of the European Central Bank, and Britain will have at least one of them. Or you cannot join the European currency and find that all the directors of that board of that bank are German. And from a British point of view, I think it's probably obvious which is the better thing to do, but maybe from a historical point of view, you can't quite come to believe that. But this disconnect is going to be enormous, because you have business firms who start to think of themselves as world business firms, but there is no world government. You see it if you look at the Mexican bailout that failed in the United States Congress. The United States Congress, looking at it from the point of view of the United States, said, "No way, Jose." On the other hand, from the point of view of the global economy, you couldn't afford to let Mexico go down the tubes. Now, in this particular case, we cobbled together some things which are probably dubious, because $20 billion came from a fund that Mr. Clinton has in the United States Treasury that's supposed to only be used for defending the American dollar, not the Mexican pesos, although he probably has the legal right to do what he's doing. But how do you get government and the global economy back in sync in some way? One of the big arguments for having a European currency is very simple. What's the only country in the world that doesn't worry about the value of its currency? The United States. Why don't we worry about the value of our currency? The answer is, if it goes down, nothing happens. Price of imports don't go up because it's such a big market that everybody prices to the American market, and the Japanese simply eat it when the value of the yen goes up. The price of Japanese cars doesn't go up. And since it's such a big currency, if you want to go to the Arctic, you go to Alaska. If you want to go to the tropics, you go to Florida. You never go abroad when you take a vacation, and so you never even notice that the value of your currency has changed. And if you think about it in a European context, it comes close to the same thing. You don't have to worry about the British pound going down when you go to take your Spanish vacation if you're using the same currency. And if you're an entire European currency, people are going to price to the European market the way they price to the American market, and you don't see big inflationary impacts when the value of your currency goes down. The next volcano or earthquake I want to talk about is the problem of the social welfare system. You remember those numbers I gave you, where the elderly in the United States, and every country is roughly similar, will be eating up 100% of the American federal budget by the time the year 2013 rolls around. Now, that clearly isn't going to happen. But the question is, how do you get out of that, given that the elderly will be very close to a voting majority at that point in time? And you also face a problem which economists know as the first and the last generation problem. Now, if you have a system of intergenerational transfers, the first generation is the big winner, because they get money from their kids, but they never had to pay for their parents. And so if you look at what they get relative to what they pay in, it's the greatest thing in the world. Who's the loser? The last generation. They paid for their parents, but there's nobody left to pay for them. A lot of what people are talking about at the moment is basically forcing the system to a world where you force people to provide more for themselves with private pensions. But that's making some generation into the last generation. They have to pay the public pension for their children, but they won't get public pension from their children, which means they have to pay for two pensions, their own and that of the generation ahead of them. And I think the historians will probably record, although it won't make anybody feel any better, that Bismarck got it wrong and Lee Kuan Yew in Singapore got it right. Bismarck designed our system of intergenerational pensions, which I think is coming to its end. In Singapore, there's something called the Provident Fund. Your employer puts 20% of your wages into the Provident Fund. You have another 20% deducted, so 40% of your gross wages go into the Provident Fund. It's run half like a mutual fund that you can direct, half run for you by some professional managers. You can spend the money on housing, health care, education in your old age, but there is no transfer from anybody else to you. You're on your own, but it's a forced savings system. It's viable in the long run. What Bismarck started for us is not viable in the long run. Now, we know what you have to do. Basic answer is you have to lengthen the working life so that people retire later and get less benefits. The other thing which you probably have to do is fund whatever social welfare system you have without using the payroll tax. Because the payroll tax creates what economists know as a tax wedge, which makes things absolutely impossible. From the point of view of the employer, you're a very expensive worker when you add in the fringe benefits and the payroll taxes. Therefore, the employer moves to wherever, let's say China, to avoid that cost. From the point of view of the worker, this is a very low-wage job when you look at the cash. And he doesn't like paying the payroll taxes, so he drops out and goes into the black economy and also doesn't pay taxes. And so you have dropouts on both sides, and of course, everybody that drops out on either side makes the whole system more unviable. That kind of a phenomenon can only be corrected if you shift away from the payroll tax and basically pay for the elderly on some kind of a consumption tax, a VAT or whatever, because it is consumption. We see that phenomenon very clearly in how it works in American healthcare. Because in American healthcare, we have nationalized healthcare for two groups of people, the elderly and the poor. The problem is, in the United States, to get the healthcare that's given to the poor, you really have to be poor. No car, no house, no assets, which means all of those things have to be used up. And so when you read about healthcare reform in the United States, you're not talking about the poor, you're not talking about the elderly, you're talking about the middle class. They don't want to become poor every time they get sick. The problem, of course, is we now have a dynamic going on where the smartest thing you can do as a business firm is get out of the business of providing private health care. Because nobody in the United States dies because some doctor refuses to treat them. They're all paid for. So how do we pay for the people who aren't covered? Well, the answer is we put a tax on the payments of the people who are covered. So if I'm an employer, I not only pay for my employees, I pay my share of the bill for all the people who aren't covered. If I drop out of the system, my employees are still essentially covered and I don't pay. And so the thing that led the Clintons to focus on health care is the fact that the number of people not covered by health care has been going up very rapidly in the United States as that dynamic works itself out. And the same thing happens if you look at the payroll tax. The problem, of course, here is how does a democracy do this and still remain viable? The next earthquake I'd like to talk about is an earthquake which I think hits political parties on the left the hardest. What does a political party on the left of the spectrum sell? The answer is they basically have to sell utopia, some vision of a better life and how you make it a better society. And if you look at political parties on the left for the last 100 years, they've basically sold two things. They've sold socialism in Europe, which is really a form of inclusion. What socialism was designed to do is say there are going to be some people that are tossed out of capitalism or don't benefit from capitalism, and this system is going to keep them included. In the United States, we never really had a political party based on socialism, but the Democratic Party was based on its variant of inclusion, which included affirmative action, public education, antitrust, a whole set of things
that were supposed to cause inclusion, exactly like socialism was supposed to cause inclusion in Europe. The other thing they've sold is the social welfare state. Some people are tossed out of the capitalistic economy when they're old, sick, or ill, and the social welfare state picks them up so that they don't get tossed down to zero level of income. The problem is that socialism has disappeared, along with communism, and the social welfare state has gone broke. You can't sell either one of them. So if you're a political party on the left, what do you sell? You can sell, we can manage the system better. But since the conservatives, a political party that sells the past, even if it's a mythical past that didn't occur, usually is the business community, what's your claim to be a better manager than they are? And how do you make it credible? And I think the basic answer is you don't. Now, if the party in power goofs it up badly enough, you may get elected. But the question is, what do you do when you get elected? What's your vision of how you make the society a better society? And you see it very clearly if you look at Felipe Gonzalez in Spain. What is he doing differently that the conservatives wouldn't do if they were elected? The answer is nothing. And that can't go on for a very long period of time. Now, what I would like to end with is, what should government do in this new world with the new plate tectonics? Remember, I mentioned that capitalism is myopic. It doesn't make long-tailed investments. What I would like to argue to you is that if we move forward, what government has to do is represent the interests of the future to the present. Of course, at the moment, because of the elderly, it's doing exactly the opposite. It's representing the interests of present to the future. I've mentioned education. If you believe that skills are the secret of success in the 21st century, and if you believe that capitalists won't make the right investments, which they won't because they're all too long-tailed, then government has a very important role to play in that area. Take research and development, long-tailed research and development. Why does biotechnology exist? Biotechnology exists because starting in the early 1970s, the American government started to put $2 to $3 billion a year into microbiology, 30 years before the first marketable product was developed. I don't have a shadow of a doubt that 1,000 years from now, people are going to look at these biotechnology and say they were the most fundamental things that happened in our epoch of human history. But it never would have happened based on capitalistic investment. Infrastructure. It's important to understand that there are certain types of infrastructure that the private economy will build and certainly some that it won't. You see it very clearly if you look at the past. Every railway in the United States east of the Mississippi River could be and was built with private money. Every railway west of the Mississippi River had to be built with government money because basically that was empty space. And the purpose of the infrastructure was to get economic activity to move into that region, but you were building the infrastructure ahead of the economic activity, and that's not what capitalism is all about. You see it very clearly in China at the moment. Gordon Wu will build a superhighway from Hong Kong to Guangdong. Who's going to build the superhighway to the middle of China, or who's going to build the superhighway from the middle of China to the western edge of China? The answer is not going to be Gordon Wu. If governments don't play the role of building that infrastructure, nobody's going to play that role. I think if you look at Newt Gingrich's contract with America, in some sense, he's got the wrong division. He wants to divide the world into private versus public. And we ought to, from his point of view, squeeze the public down and push the private up. I think that's the wrong division. The right division is the division between investment and consumption. Some of the investment that has to go up is in the public sector. Some of the investment that has to go up is in the private sector. Some of the consumption that has to go down is in the public sector. Some of the consumption that has to go down is in the private sector. Now, one of the places where this has become very difficult is due to the fact that basically we have hidden our investment in the military budgets. The Cold War was, in fact, the mechanism for forcing ourselves to invest. Let me give you a few examples in the United States. As I mentioned, I and about 3/4 of all the other PhDs in America in the 60s and 70s got our PhDs on the National Defense Education Act. We were all justified as a military necessity. If you take the interstate highway system in the United States, which was designed in the 1950s and built in the 60s and 70s, that official act was called the National Defense Transportation Act. And our argument for doing it was we had to move mobile missiles around the country that the Russians couldn't hit. All the bridges had to be high enough for the missile trucks to get under them, and therefore we needed an interstate highway system. And the military pays for half of all the R&D in America. Noam Chomsky, who teaches linguistics at the United States, was funded by the United States Navy. There was a very broad interpretation, like the Prussian nursery rhyme, you know, for want of the nail, the shoe was lost, for want of the shoe, the horse was lost, for want of the horse, the rider was lost, for want of the rider, the battle was lost. It was pushed very hard. The problem is, that's gone. What's the ideology that's going to make us invest? I think if you look at it historically, every society that has been successful over some long period of time has probably, from the point of view of capitalism, been an over-investor. And they've all had some motive force that led them to over-invest. For the Romans, it was the empire that was going to last forever. Today, you can go and ride on the Appian Way. It is not an accident that you can do that. You know how they built it? They dug a trench 15 feet deep. They filled that trench with about 10 feet of rock, and then on the top of it, they had notched rocks that were about 3 feet thick that interlaced with each other. Of course you can drive on that highway 2,000 years later. It was built to last 2,000 years. The Egyptians, of course, are very interesting from this point of view. Somebody the other day did a study, engineering study. They basically asked the question, suppose somebody dropped a neutron bomb, so every human being on the face of the earth died, and so nothing got maintained. What would be the last remnant of human civilization left on the face of the globe? Well, all the skyscrapers in New York would go very fast because without maintenance, the basements would fill up with salt water. Their steel structures, they would rust and they would topple over and they would be gone. The great dams like Grand Coulee Dam would sooner or later fill up with ice, plug up the spillways, and they would be gone. They came to the conclusion that the last thing on the face of the earth would be the first thing that we now know of, the pyramids. They were built to last forever, and they are lasting forever. And of course, the interesting thing about the Egyptian pharaohs is they lived in mud houses and they built stone tombs, because they thought the life after death was more important than life. We, in some sense, did that on space. When John F. Kennedy announced the space race, nobody said, how much is it going to cost? The answer was, we're going to do it. The problem you also have, if you think about it from this point of view, is we're going to ask capitalism to do what it does least well. We're going to ask it to invest in the distant future, and we're going to ask it to make deliberate structural adjustments in social and institutional systems. And the problem is that capitalism is a doctrine of radical individualism that says you don't have to worry about systems. Because the argument is the best system always comes to the top. That's what the competitive market's all about. But the question is, will the best system always come to the top? I think periods like the Dark Ages say they don't always come to the top. Human beings have lived for very long periods of time when there, in fact, was all the technology out there to do something better, and it didn't come to the top. The other problem you have is, how does any social system change when it doesn't have a competitor? If you look at the great changes in the capitalistic system, it all occurred because there was a socialistic competitor. Bismarck invented public health insurance and public pensions, as I mentioned, in the 1880s. Why did he do it? To keep the communists out. Churchill basically invented, when he was Chancellor of the Exchequer in 1906, the first public system of unemployment insurance. Why did he do it? To keep the opposition out. Roosevelt, probably the most aristocratic president America has ever had, invented America's social welfare state. Why? Because at the local level, a lot of little towns were electing communist city governments in the 1930s. And if there is no competitor out there putting pressure on you, how do you reform? Can a social system reform itself when there is no competitor? If you look at it historically, it is very hard to find times when people have been willing to make reforms when they didn't feel themselves under some kind of competitive pressure from the outside. Now the question is, where do we go from here? The answer to that question, of course, is I don't know. The plate tectonics are going to work themselves out. But one of the things I've been doing, which I want to just mention a similarity, and I don't want to be quoted to saying this is what we're going to do. But one of the things that is absolutely fascinating is go to the Middle and Dark Ages and look for similarities with today's era. People have pointed out that if you look at Imperial Rome, the thing that about it was interesting was the enormous investments in public buildings relative to the relatively small investments in private buildings. The exact opposite was true in the Middle Ages. The public squeezed out, the private squeezed out the public. In the Middle Ages, we built walled cities. In the United States at the moment, we're building walled cities. In the Middle Ages, people worried about street violence and youth gangs. We're now worrying about street violence and youth gangs. And if you said, where does serfdom come from? The answer is people sold themselves into serfdom to gain the safety from these kind of roaming gangs. The Middle Ages were full of homeless, wandering all around Europe by the hundreds of thousands. Everybody believed in capital punishment. It was the solution to all the problems. At the bottom of the Middle Ages, there were 100 crimes in Great Britain for which you could be executed. Yet only one out of every 100 murders was solved. It was an era of religious fundamentalism. You went around flagellating yourself, which was the fundamentalism of that day and age. We have an era of religious fundamentalism. There was no vision of a better life, how to make society better. Literacy was down. At the peak, most of Imperial Rome could read. A few generations later, just a few monks in Europe could read. On the other hand, what did we develop during the famous Dark Ages that now leads the historians to want to call them the Middle Ages? It was where we developed the belief in technology and the belief in individual rights, out of which the Renaissance sprang. And so if we think about the plate tectonics, which way is it going to go, up or down? Thank you very much. Who would like to start the questions tonight? I'll repeat them as I have been doing so everybody can.
Can you write at the front there?
What do you think the purpose of economy is? And what is the economy of the best?
Question is, what do I think the purpose of the economy is, and where would I place my bets? Purpose of the economy is to generate a high standard of living, where we have to define what are the ingredients of that high standard of living. And I think also a purpose of economy is to allow you to explore new fields, new areas. If you think about it economically, it didn't make any sense to do the space shot. Still doesn't make any sense to do the space shot. But it was an exciting thing to do. And I think human beings have to do exciting things. Now, I think one of the other places where you've got a problem is we don't, or we shouldn't, just live in a consumption world. The production process in itself is a fun thing to do and a fun thing to participate in. And probably one of the problems with the ideology of capitalism is it's an ideology which says work is a disutility. You got to hate your job because that's the only reason you get paid, is if you hate your job. Because if it wasn't a disutility, nobody would pay you. But I know about my life, I could maybe go to the beach for 2 hours, skiing for 2 weeks, mountain climbing for 2 months, but damn it, I've taught economics for 25 years. Something there doesn't compute if you think about work as a disutility. So I think the answer is exactly what ought to be in the economy is not clear. Now, in terms of who you would place your bets on in the third world, clearly at the moment you'd place one of your bets on China. Beyond that, I guess the answer is you'd place your bets on those people you think that are going to get organized to generate a skilled workforce, because the skilled workforce is going to be as important in the third world as it is in the first world. And so if you look at a country like India, I'm very ambivalent. Because on one level, people say, well, they got 100 million of people who are getting educated. That's true. But they got 800 million who are not. And I don't think you can run a modern industrial economy based on a kind of an enclave economy where you've got 100 million educated people and then 800 million who are not. And so I think the question is, are you doing it across the board? If you look at Brazil and compare it with China, I think the Chinese have the strategy right and Brazil has the strategy wrong. The Chinese basically have a strategy of starting from the bottom. Get everybody through the third grade, then get everybody through the sixth grade, then get everybody through the ninth grade, then get everybody through the 12th grade, and then worry about the universities. The Brazilians have done it the opposite. They poured a lot of money into universities, and they got half the kids who don't go to grade school. And it just doesn't work, despite the fact that we're in universities, and having people pour money into universities from that point of view is kind of a good thing. So the question, I think, here on the third world is, who's got a good educational strategy? Because that's what's going to determine their income, just like it determines our income.
Yep. Right at the back there.
I have a specific question on the U.S. economy, interest rates and the Federal Reserve. The U.S. economy has been growing above trend for almost 6 quarters now, and the capacity utilization figures are extremely high, and the output gap is almost closed. Productivity has been extremely strong in the U.S. labor market, and the unemployment figures have been lower than they have ever been in history. So we have these three very strong potential reasons for the economy. Don't you think interest rate policy would be, first of all, dependent upon domestic economic conditions? And if they are dependent on domestic economic conditions, isn't Alan Greenspan right in putting up interest rates to curb the inflationary expectations?
Well, the basic answer, I think, is we're now in a global economy where those kind of local capacity utilization rates don't make any difference. The fact of the matter is, on a global basis, we're not growing fast, and there's a lot of excess capacity. And that shows up by the fact that there are not only is no sign of inflation, there's no sign of it even accelerating by the tiniest bit. And the interesting thing is each of the 7 times that Alan Greenspan has raised interest rates, he's been forced to admit, I can find no inflation in the data. And see, you're not willing to buy the argument that I made that the world is fundamentally different than it was in the 70s and 80s. What he's doing now would have been perfectly appropriate if it was 1986 or 1976. But I think the answer is it's not appropriate in 1995 because calculating some American output gap is not the way you do those kind of calculations in 1995.
Yes, Tony. Could you speak up, please?
They're devastating certain implications, and they seem to flow with a kind of inexorability. One is reminded of the strategy of earthquake management, which focuses not on preventative measures, but on palliative measures. I wonder whether you might have, in preparation of some book, which addresses
Well, the answer is yes, I'm going to try and write that book. But I think your analysis is right, because what I've been trying to argue is most of these fundamental forces cannot be changed, like the earthquake. The question is, how do you adjust to them? How do you build buildings that will survive the earthquake? How do you adjust to the fact that the era of the dinosaurs are over? It's a period of punctuated equilibrium that's going to go off in a very different direction. And see, if you think about this issue of what does capitalism mean in a world of human capital, I think that's a perfect illustration of the problem. You can't go back to the steam economy. That isn't what the future of capitalism is going to be. Now, are we going to organize our economy all like it was Arthur Anderson? We're going to find some new form of organization to have into our economy. What is that new social contract? See, I think those are the things that basically have to be worked out. Now, the people who succeed the best are obviously the people who figure that out the fastest as to how you work in that new environment that didn't exist in the past.
Yes.
Well, as I mentioned last time, I think that's one of the real conundrums. Because as I said at the end of my lecture last night, there are lots of human societies that have lasted for very long periods of time with enormous degrees of inequality. But they've all had an ideology that justified inequality. The problem with democracy is it's a one-person, one-vote ideology that basically is based on egalitarian principles. And how do you put egalitarian democratic principles together with an economy that's moving in a very inequalitarian way? We've never done it because the history of democracy is relatively recent. And during that period of time, we were basically moving towards equality because we were gradually adding these social welfare measures and educational measures that boosted people's income. We don't have any experience of major democracies existing for long periods of time with great inequality and moving towards more inequality. And so I think that's one of the fundamental tensions. It's like in some sense, if you want to use my analogy, it's the San Andreas fault. It's the biggest fault out there because it's two fundamentally different ideologies side by side. And they've been made compatible in the past using the social welfare state. But since you can't use that going into the future, how do you make them compatible going into the future? And I think it affects all of us no matter how long we've had a democracy.
To back that.
In talking about the 7 to 8 years scope of capital investment, do you believe that capital markets are not as efficient as patient capital provided for the Mindland model?
No, but that is the efficient because, you know, for private loans, interest rates are going to be around 7-8%, right? With an interest rate of 7-8%, 7 or 8 years is the right time horizon. The average business firm time horizon is actually 3. So I was being very generous to the business community by talking about a 7 or 8 year time horizon. It's not that that's the wrong rational time horizon. That's the right rational time horizon. The problem is our societies need to do some things that are on much longer time horizons. If you take research, for example, if you're talking about research that will pay off in the next 6 years, business firms will do that. If you're talking about research that isn't going to pay off for 15 years, they're not going to touch that, and then there may be some things in between that they will. You know, a year or so ago, IBM went through its research budget, and it took $3 billion out of its research budget. You know what it did? It killed every program that wasn't going to pay off in 5 years. Very simple decision rule. Because the only people doing long-tailed research were business firms that basically had monopoly positions that could act a little bit like governments, the AT&Ts, the pay-tay-tay monopolies, or a company like IBM that for a long time had such a dominant position, it didn't have to worry about competitive pressure.
And to be fair, family firms. I mean,
right.
Family firms that care about their children and their grandchildren will do it, or quasi-family firms like the Japanese construct.
Well, see, I think it's partly that they care about their grandchildren, but it's something very different, too. Yeah. If you take the Mars family, which runs the Candy family, which is the biggest private firm in America with sales of something like $15 billion, all owned by one company, $5 billion bigger than McDonald's. They spend all their money on their company because what the hell else are they going to spend it on? They've got everything they want. They care about the company more than anything else, and so they pour it all back in. And so it's partly their children, but it's partly that this is their definition of existence.
Sure.
They're empire builders in the Roman sense. And they invest like the Romans.
But I mean, that's generally true. I mean, Alistair Pilkington has said that the float glass project would never have been funded in a public company. And of course, he's right. And as soon as Pilkington's went public, all that R&D went.
No, now, I think you see the same thing if you look at fiber optics in Corning,
oh, sure.
which is owned by one family.
So maybe the future of capitalism is for the families. There. You know, DNA counts. I mean, you're right. I'm a molecular biologist. By the way, I was funded by the Office of Naval Research to do my PhD in Britain. Right. You're in the back there.
How do you get society to, how do you
Well, some of the investment isn't public, but see, I think that that is the $64 trillion question. Because, you see, there's something else that's working against it. Modern media. You know, people have done a lot of content analysis of TVs and movies. TVs and movies have some interesting characteristics. First of all, with the exception of cops and drug dealers, nobody works. But secondly, nobody ever makes investments in the future because, of course, that would be boring. You got a 30-minute TV program or a two-hour movie. How the hell can you invest in the future? And so what you, and of course, the other thing, as I mentioned, what you have coming into your house most often is the TV family, which gives you this exaggerated idea of how wealthy people are, so you're trying to keep up with their consumption standards of living. And so the media, if anything, pushes towards less investment. And see, I think that's one of the places where you really have to say, what quality of public leadership are we going to have? And here you've got a real problem, because a modern leader has a problem that Harry Truman doesn't have. When the Republicans won the election in November, there was a lot of talk in the American press, should Bill Clinton be a Harry Truman, give him hell Harry, who was the last Democratic president who had a Republican Congress, or should he try to accommodate the Newt Gingriches? And as somebody pointed out, there was a fundamental difference between Bill Clinton and Harry Truman. Harry Truman never looked at a public opinion poll. Bill Clinton sleeps with him. And the problem with a public opinion poll is that they're very good. If you're a politician, they give you the option of jumping to the front of where the parade is going and making yourself look like a leader when you're in fact a follower. If you were Harry Truman, there were some public opinion polls at that time, but they were so bad that they didn't tell you anything that you need that was relevant. You had to lead because you had no choice. And the question is, are we going to find ways to lead ourselves in the right direction on those investment issues? And I think probably instead of having a constitutional amendment in the United States about a balanced budget, we ought to have a constitutional amendment saying that we refuse to let investment in the public budget go below whatever we think the right threshold level is, as opposed to the issue of balance or not balance, because the real thing at jeopardy is those investment funds in the budgets.
At the back there.
Well, I think there's a tremendous problem because you're talking about, if you think about what are the rules of how you play the game under communism, they're very different under capitalism. It would be very peculiar if a group of human beings could make an instant transition. And the problem you have, if you look in China, is it has no system of contracts or enforcing contracts. The Chinese will gladly sign a contract, but it's just a starting point. It doesn't have any meaning in the sense that which contracts are kind of meant seriously in the Western world. And you see that all at the moment with all this hassle about banks that have lent money to various Chinese firms. The Chinese firms are not paying back. The banks say, hey, you signed, did you agree to do this in the contract? And the Chinese want to negotiate about it. Now, the same thing is true on intellectual property rights. You're talking about a part of the world that traditionally has not had a belief in intellectual property rights. But capitalism needs a belief in intellectual property rights. It isn't just China. The first time I went to South Korea, which is probably two decades ago now, they rolled out everything I had written that they translated into Korean and wanted me to be pleased. They never had asked me. They never had paid me. They just did it. And they never thought they did anything wrong. Hey, that's just the way the world works. You know, we translated your book into Korean. You should be glad we translated your book into Korean. And so those are some places where you got some real cultural gaps. Now, the problem, of course, is you didn't used to worry about things like books and movies because nobody made a lot of money on them. But today they do. And therefore, you start to worry about these things. And so, you know, that whole issue is going to have to be straightened out in order to make the system work. And at the moment, you've got the United States and China on the verge of a trade war about those copyright, trademark-type issues.
Last question, dude.
Well, the answer is it won't happen automatically. But it has to happen, right? We know the elderly can't take 120% of all the money there is. That's a fact. So at some point, you've got to find a way to stop it. But it isn't going to happen automatically simply by people say, hey, I love to work. Let me work another 3 years, and I'll feel good about life. So, you know, there again, it's something that's going to require enormous organization and leadership to make it done, even though you know it has to be done. It is a necessity. It will be done. But the question is it done in a very painful, disruptive way, or do you find some way to do it that isn't so painful and disruptive? Thank you.
Well, we've had a treat, and on behalf of you all who were here tonight and your predecessors, many of you I know were the same, who were here the other two lectures, I would like to thank on your behalf Lester Thurow for a fascinating, stimulating, frightening, and partly wrong prediction. The problem I have is I don't know which part is wrong. Thank you very much.